welcome to another Training Tidbits podcast with your hosts, me, Ryan Cartledge from Animal Training Academy, and Dr. Kat Gregory from Creative Animal Solutions. For today, what Dr. Kat and I are going to do is rewind to an email I sent out about a month and a half ago now, asking for people's input on the biggest things about animal training that they wanted to talk about and learn about. So from that email, I got a good flood of great responses, and we're going to go try and answer some of those questions for you today and over the next wee while. We're going to go over four of them today. They're pretty broad, but we'll see how we go. Before we do though, I just wanted to extend a massive thank you to all the support that you out there have shown us. This is a fifth podcast to go up on Animal Training Academy's website. Three of those have been with myself and Dr. Kat, and I released a pilot episode with a trainer from Poland last week. And I'm super excited to say, and I haven't even told you this, Dr. Kat, as of this morning on the website, we have just reached 500 downloads.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, and I think our first podcast was released end of January, so that's absolutely huge, and obviously couldn't do it without all your support.
Thanks, everyone, that you're impatient enough to actually listen to us. I'm grateful as well as Ryan, I'm sure.
If you did want to check out the rest of the episodes, then they're all up on animaltrainingacademy.com, as well as the Training Tidbits one on Creative Animal Solutions. And if you head to animaltrainingacademy.com, you've also got the Training Tidbits online course there, and I think the free course is up to 11 free lessons at the moment, so check that out. And next month as well, I'm going to be hosting the first ever Animal Training Academy live event. So we're going to be having a bit of a jam session, or in other words, a webinar or live teaching event. So as of today, I have about 50 people signed up for that. And by the time we release this podcast, I'll put a link in the website and you can sign up for that if you're interested in that. It's going to be towards the end of April. Like I said, it's going to be live. So I have some really special stuff we're going to go over on that webinar. It's going to be a lot of fun. And of course, there'll be a live Q&A and lots of opportunities to interact. And also members of the academy can interact in that space. So I haven't set a date yet, but check in on the website for more information at animaltrainingacademy.com. But back to this podcast and our questions from our audience. Let's get cracking. Are you ready, Dr. Kat?
Yes.
The first question is how can I work with animals that are easily distracted? That's a pretty big question, but we're going to attempt to go over it in about 5 minutes. But if it takes longer, we'll just answer as many questions as we can out of the four we've chosen in the next 30, 35 minutes. Do you want to start us off there, Dr. Kat?
I often get that from different clients, and they always complain that my animal isn't able to concentrate during a training session. He can't concentrate for more than 5 minutes, or can't concentrate for more than a second. And I guess I reflect it back to them. It's not about the animal not wanting to be engaged, but you creating a session that in which the animal has a great desire to be engaged. And how do you as the trainer create that, rather than putting blame on an animal saying that he's not motivated by X, Y, or Z? What you have to do as a trainer is to create a session and create a stage on which the animal can perform, in which he has every desire to be engaged. So what I would suggest is if the animal is easily distracted by the environment, then the environment's more interesting than you at that time. That doesn't mean it's consistent, but it means that you as a trainer have to create the desire in the animal to focus on you. I guess, what have you got some thoughts on that, Ryan?
I guess you're kind of asking, well, kind of why are the animals distracted? And do we need to change the environment, or do we need to start the training somewhere with less distractions maybe? Like you just said, you're not the most interesting thing at this point in time, but that's not meaning to say that you're not going to be the most interesting thing in the future. You just have to make sure that those distractions, those competing reinforcers, things in that animal's environment that are competing for what it is that you're offering, you have to make sure that at the start anyway, those things are minimalized, and over time do some training with more and more distractions, or make sure, I mean, I guess there's a lot of things going on there, isn't there? Do we need to look at our reinforcers, analyze what we're using to try and train? Maybe we just don't have the correct reinforcers.
And it's not just that you're using reinforcement, it's the way you're using it as well. Are you actually reinforcing? And I guess the trick, there's a law called the matching law, where an animal or a human or any living being will engage in the behavior that is most reinforcing to it, most rewarding to it. So if the animal appears to be distracted in training, then there are other things going on that are more interesting and more reinforcing for that animal to engage its attention. So what you have to do as a trainer is to create that environment. And yes, you can set the stage in a less distracting environment, and that's often useful when you, particularly when you have a very a novice animal and a novice and a new history with that animal. So
yeah, so you have to kind of think about what the learning history of the individual animal is. And I guess I'm doing that currently with my little puppy Phoebe. We're loose leash walking, which we're doing fantastic in the garage. And at the moment, we're not really walking on a leash. Got the long extendable one that I put her on if need be, and she can kind of move away from me and it won't pull on her chest or her throat because she's got the harness on. But we're doing it perfectly in the garage, and we've just opened the garage door and we just started going outside with the lead on. So she's going well, but you know, that animal, we're trying to minimize distractions for her at the moment and get a high level of consistency in the environment with minimal distractions, and we'll slowly start adding those distractions and reinforcing the correct behavior as we go and move towards loose leash walking in on the street and in other more distracting environments where there's lots of things to smell and there's other dogs walking around and there's cars and there's things that are going to distract her. But she hasn't learned that, and we can't really say that she's stubborn or she's this, that, or the other because she hasn't learned that. We have to teach her that. So I guess in that situation, yeah, take it back and look at the individual and what the individual's learned. You want to add anything?
What I tend to do is when the environment is up and the environment is potentially more distracting, in inverted commas, for the animal with which I'm working, I tend to increase the intensity and rate of reinforcement to a very high level to maintain that focus from my animal. So instead of I see a lot of trainers tending to drop off the rate of reinforcement a little bit or a lot too soon quite often, and then allow the animal to start looking for reinforcement from other areas of its world. So I would say that at least maintain your rate of reinforcement, but ideally as you move forward into moving the animal to a greater level of distraction in your environment, then increase the intensity of your reinforcement rate and potentially have good variety in your reinforcement too to maintain interest in your games.
Yeah, and I guess the thing it comes down to, summing all of that up, is you've got to look at your individual animal as well, don't you? And kind of rather than a generic answer, you've got to understand what works and what's the reinforcers for that animal. And also other things, like there's so many factors that come into play there. You know, what's the daily routine like? Do we have someone asking why their animal's distracted when they're trying to train them after they've just had a big meal and they're trying to use kibble? So many different elements. Should we move on to the next question? I think we've given a pretty broad answer there, but the takeaway message is have a look at all those factors and have a look at your individual animal and your individual environment and watch behavior and measure behavior and try things and see what influence it has on.
And don't blame the animal. Behavior. Don't blame the animal. You are the person in control of the session.
So important.
So if it seems to be out of control, then reassess what you're doing. Take a step back, breathe, and have a look at what else you can do to create a better setting for that training to go forward.
Yeah. So question number two is how to maintain behavior once trained. Dr. Cat, how do we maintain behavior once it's been trained?
I'd probably test to see if depends on what, when do I call a behavior trained? That's first definition, I suppose. What is a trained behavior, Ryan?
I'm going to make an assumption here. The context that it was asked in is someone had a behavior in their mind and they've gone through a shaping process and they've reached that final behavior. Let's say it's a dog sitting on cue. I'm assuming it's a complete behavior. The animal has learned that, hey, the environment's telling me to do something, it does it, and the reinforcement comes after that.
A trained behavior to me, in the definition of the term, is a behavior that occurs that is under stimulus control. That means that the behavior is only offered when the cue is given, and it's not offered outside that cue, and then it's reinforced. The cue is given, the behavior is offered, and then that behavior is reinforced. It should flow from that to the point of reinforcement. Sometimes people think behaviors are trained and they're actually not. And they haven't proofed it. Proofing means that the behavior will be offered regardless of what's going on in the environment. So that means you've got it in one space, like you've got it in the garage with your puppy, the walking on a loose lead, and then you need to generalize that behavior. Some animals need more opportunities to generalize their behavior than others, I find. Dogs seem to need a lot of practice. Some cats don't seem to need a lot of practice, and some individual animals don't need a lot of practice, but many, many really do need the opportunity to practice and understand that whenever that cue is given, that is when they perform that behavior. So how do we maintain it? That's a good question. Well, how would you maintain it? I guess the trick is also that I sort of mentioned it in the last answer, is to not drop off your rate of reinforcement for that given behavior too early, so that the animal then again doesn't look for alternate options in the environment that will reinforce it or that will interest it, maintain its interest, and it will find reinforcing. So I would maintain it also by varying my reinforcers. Very varying my environment and making sure it's really there, like making sure that no matter what, whenever I offer that stimulus, that the behavior is offered on cue at that moment in time without hesitation, without any hesitation whatsoever. If there's any hesitation and the animal hasn't been trained correctly or well, put it that way. Is there anything else that you would like to add, Ryan?
When I was just writing down some ideas for that question, I didn't go as in depth as to what trained look like. I generalized myself. It's a behavior that fits the criterion that you just described. Okay. I mean, yeah, I guess the way you'd maintain it, the immediate thing that came to my head was reinforce it. And remember, you know, the definition of reinforcer is something that immediately follows behavior and serves to maintain and slash or increase the frequency of that behavior in the future. So if you want to maintain behavior, then you set up a reinforcement schedule where it's maintained, and that can be continuous, where every occurrence of the behavior is followed by a reinforcer, or put it on a variable schedule. How do you know what one?
And reinforcement variety is important to explore as well with that individual.
So how do you know what reinforcers to explore or what schedule to use? I guess it depends on your application, but the ultimate question is what effect it's having on the frequency of behavior. And if you have a high frequency and you are able to maintain behavior via what you're doing, then you're reinforcing the behavior. So keep doing it. And if the behavior starts to break down, once again, there's lots of possibilities here, but I dare say you would have got your reinforcers. If you are offering reinforcers, but the frequency of behavior is decreasing, then what you think is a reinforcer might not be a reinforcer. And I say might not because other aspects might be at play, such as timing.
Yeah. Additionally, other things might be coming into the environment or affecting the individual animal that might make that behavior being offered very difficult for that animal for a variety of reasons. And that might be other individuals in the environment. It might be the environment itself. It might be the level of association. It might be the stage of the performance that you're asking for that behavior, and the animal is already heavily satiated. Is there any motivation for that behavior at that point? All those little things. I guess the other thing too is don't try and work this problem through necessarily during a session. If you're having trouble, try and finish quickly on a good note with a well-known behavior and a good rate of response from the animal, and without hesitation it will perform that behavior, and then finish on a good note, then step back and breathe and make a plan forward about how to address what you see or perceive as an issue.
Yeah, and I guess the kind of overriding answer to both those questions as well is, I think it comes down to two things. Kind of one is understanding what reinforcement works and how it works, correctly understanding that and knowing that you don't just have to use food, as you correctly identified before, you know, having a variety of reinforcers, but and watching the effect it has on behavior and measuring behavior, but also that there's so many variables. You've really got to take it as a study of one and kind of look at the individual and what's going on in the individual environment. There's so many elements, isn't there?
Yeah, and that's why it's often useful to have an observer or get someone to video what you're doing, because the animal may not be doing what you think it's doing, as you the individual trainer may not be picking up things in the environment that are quite clear to the animal to look at. That's why when I used to ride, we used to ride in arenas with mirrors in them all the time, so we could actually see. When you're riding a horse, it's very difficult to see what you're actually doing, but mirrors are given to you by videos and observers of your training session. So if you are having trouble, use your colleagues around you and use people who are neutrally not involved emotionally with the event in question, and you can certainly nut out a plan together and move forward in a more probably a more efficient way. Make use of your colleagues.
And I was thinking about this the other day. Also, I was thinking about the first animal I ever trained, and I didn't have a video camera back then, and it was 10 years or so ago, and we didn't have smartphones and all this stuff. And I just used to write pretty intense notes, so at least I could go back and kind of review what I'd done and what had happened. But just a quick note on video recording: if you've got money, go buy a GoPro. If you seriously want to get better and get better faster, I think, because like Kat said, you pick up on stuff on a video camera or in mirrors that you don't otherwise see. If you've got a digital camera, if you can get a tripod, great. Get someone else to film it, or lean your smartphone up against the wall, or hold it in one hand if you can. I mean, sometimes you can do that. But yeah, I think that's great advice. Try to watch it back if you can and see what's going on. Cool. Well, that was sorry, go on.
No, it's all right. I think don't underestimate the ability of a non-emotional observer as well. And that means someone who's sometimes I find with clients of mine that I see who are having trouble doing X, Y, Z with their animal, I think they're always emotionally attached to the event, and me coming in without emotion and just to observe from a neutral standpoint, I often see things more clearly without that emotional baggage. So having observers watch you is really important, and everybody, I reckon, probably has that opportunity. And if you don't, most people have access to some sort of video equipment without great cost that will help you improve exponentially. actually.
On that note, I was filming some training recently and I asked a person to come and hold the camera who was a emotionally unattached person, and I was emotionally attached to training because I was the one doing the training and investing a lot of time in it. And I'm learning about myself from filming that I'm so focused on the animal and what I'm doing that the comments and stuff in the background, they're being filtered out at the time of the training because I'm so focused on the animal that I've actually learned stuff from the unemotionally attached observers who are commenting in the background, not necessarily me after, but I'm watching it and listening. They're saying and going, oh yeah, I didn't even hear that because I was so focused on what I was doing.
Or he's watching your hand and he's not watching your cue. He's listening and he's not watching. Yeah. He's blah blah blahing. Yeah. Yep. All those little things. And what I will say is all of our animals are very, very good at reading our body language, often better than we are of each other. Yeah. And that's where video comes in again.
Our animals watch us so much. They just sit there and watch us, don't they?
Yeah. I had a competition dog that I used to work a lot, and I used to have to be extremely careful with my cueing when I was competing with her, because if I did anything, she would think it was a cue. Anything. Yeah, right. Or she would try and work out what that meant. She was so amazing. She was an amazing animal. She was a very, very good teacher, very sensitive to my body language, and taught me a great deal.
I like filming people at dog parks sometimes, and they're talking to their animals, and they think their animals are following their vocal instructions and then having a conversation with them like you would a human being. But then watching the videos back and watching what the dogs are looking at, the dogs are responding to, it can be quite humorous. But we've spent enough time on that question, I think some really cool insights there and some good ideas. So we'll move on to the next one. And the next question is, how can training help with plucking and self-mutilation? How can training help with plucking and self-mutilation?
Okay, or any stereotypic behavior, I would suggest as well, that appears to be of concern in the sense that there is some damage or harm occurring to the individual or others in the environment. I deal with this sort of thing all the time, and a lot of people focus on trying to correct that sort of behavior, i.e. often punishing it or trying to stop the animal in some way from performing the behavior. And that can go all the way from, say, if a dog is or a cat is sucking its tail, people can make the tail taste bad and so aim to punish the act of sucking your tail. The problem is, from the animal's perspective, by merely punishing the behavior, you are not teaching the animal anything that it can do. Yeah. And so I find that training is a really useful tool for these animals, giving them and teaching them a range of alternate behaviours that are not self-injurious, that it can partake in, that are not self-injurious or harming in that same sort of way. I guess I look at that sort of behaviour as a red flag, like there is something or there has been something in that animal's environment often that is causing it some level of anxiety. I guess being, from my perspective, being a vet behaviourist, I always encourage people when they have animals in this situation is to ensure that the animal has a full, proper health check by someone who is knowledgeable with that species. You need to make sure that the animal's not painful or not sick before you start looking at it as a behavioural issue. You make sure that you get that animal checked to make sure there isn't a reason for it to be doing that. Because some animals will lick and chew at a site that's extremely uncomfortable for it as well, or sometimes redirect it at a remote site because it's uncomfortable in its tummy. It might lick some other part of its body.
And I always ask that to anyone anyway. If we're starting any training program, I'll always ask if there's any health issues or anything, because that's one of the most vital and important parts. But I remember I won't go down that story. I was about to tell a story, but that would distract us too much. So we'll get back to the question, how can training help with plucking and self-mutilation? From a behavioural perspective, after we've gone through the vet stuff, my response would be to give the animal other things to do other than plucking, and you kind of already alluded to that. And kind of trying to think about what's reinforcing that behaviour, although we're probably not going to be able to measure that if it's internal. And how can we train an alternative behavior that delivers similar reinforces but isn't self-injurious or still damaging? How can we train a similar behavior to plucking? I mean, maybe we can give it other things to do, train it to do other things that require the same kind of behavior. For example, and this isn't self-injurious, but this is just my dogs and cats at home chasing each other. And sometimes I interpret that play as unwanted from either party. Sometimes it seems play, but sometimes one of the parties doesn't seem to really want to be engaged in that. And I try to give the animals opportunity opportunities throughout the day to chase things. The cats.
So you redirect it. You say, if you want to use that style of whatever, then use it this way, which I find more acceptable, basically. So I do that too. So if you've got, I look at what the animal prefers to do. Say if a dog likes to chew things up and destroy them, I say the enrichment that should be given to that animal or the training option should be stuff that it can direct its mouth towards, because it clearly is a way, it's something that the animal finds reinforcing, but it may be inappropriately directed at the time that you first called in to help. Don't necessarily give it something that it wouldn't necessarily like to do. You can work on other things later and expand its repertoire later, but look at what it likes to do. Use that energy. I call it channeling energy in today's language, I suppose. And I don't want to, I walk into a situation where people are, they worry that I'm going to change the animal entirely. I don't want to change the animal. I want it to use its energy in a better way.
And be creative with that. I mean, with Phoebe the dog, I went to the hardware store and bought a 10-meter piece of elastic. And I went to the Salvation Army store and brought a bag full of soft toys. And I cut the elastic up and tied soft toys to the end of it. And I just stand in a single spot at the dog park and just kind of move it around my body. And Phoebe loves it. I don't think there's anything else in Phoebe's life currently that she loves more than that toy. But we can get half an hour of intense chasing out with Phoebe that is channeling that energy away from chasing the cats at home.
Yeah, she's got an outlet for that chase behavior, but it's actually okay. It's not going to cause any harm to the cats.
Yeah, it just gives me a really sore arm.
get a fishing rod and put it on the end of that.
I've got a garden stake. I put it on the garden stake. And then she grabs it and we play a nice little tug. Garden stake's tiny now because I've broken it so many times.
And bungee cords are really good too for hanging from tree branches that are solid as well. So bungee cords. But also, the key to enrichment is also to observe your animal before you leave it alone with anything. Yep. Please do that.
And of course, we can't say that anything is successful or unsuccessful without measuring the frequency and or strength of behavior before and after the interventions. And it's going to be different for each individual. So I could go and spend half an hour playing chase with this elastic thing and we could see zero decrease in frequency of chasing the cats. I could go and try to play for longer or try different. So just keep that in mind.
And put my hand up. Yep. The other thing that is also useful to remember is that sometimes also it's useful to teach an animal that calm behavior will get everything it wants as well. For a lot of the animals that we work with, it's very easy to turn them on, to switch them on. But what we have to teach them is a level of self-control that's important as well. But a calm animal should learn, and some do it innately and some need to be taught, that offering calm behaviors will get you lots of reinforcement. That's important. I think a lot of people forget that. They spend a lot of time G-ing their animals up but don't teach it a level of self-control. That is also important. But you have to teach the animal that being calm is reinforcing as well.
I think that's so fun to teach. And I've been teaching puppies and kittens recently, but it's fun to teach that self-control. I enjoy it.
And you're not going to change the exuberance of the animal. The animal will still be the same, able to be switched on quite easily by whatever other options you give it. But I see a lot of animals that are over anxious and their activity is over the top. And I also want to teach a lot of those animals that being calm and allowing others to be not chased or not harmed around them or no agonistic behavior towards conspecifics is ideal. That if they offer calm behavior, I will pay attention to that. A lot of people don't pay attention to animals when they're being calm.
They want them to be calm, but then they don't get reinforced for that.
And it's also a key when you're teaching veterinary procedure behaviours that you need to teach the animal that being still is reinforcing, and you need to reinforce that behavior heavily, because for veterinary procedures to go ahead, you have to understand that animals have to be still often for prolonged periods of time. When we're ultrasounding, when we're taking blood, when we're doing radiographs, animals have to be still. But if they have never found that to be reinforcing, they are not going to offer it when you want it.
And it's not just the animals have high anxiety. If you've got an animal that's got no self-control, or it's just active or busy the whole time, the owners is going to be on high anxiety levels the whole time as well, because it's going to be challenging to control that animal. I was just thinking about this yesterday, Dr. Cat. When you say take the time, it's going to save you time in the long run. And I did some maths yesterday, right? If you do a training session for 2 minutes every day and you do 10, you offer 10 bits of reinforcement in that training session, that's 70 opportunities a week to reinforce your animal for doing something that you label as desirable. And if you calculate that over a year, that's 3,640 opportunities to reinforce your animal for doing the things you want, right? You know, everyone's at the different levels of training and everyone's better at picking up timing or slightly worse at timing. These are all things that you can learn as well. But anyone with 3,640 opportunities to reinforce their animal is going to be moving towards better behavior, if not at least have a ridiculously high trust account and good relationship with those animals. So 2 minutes a day, 2 minutes a day. Not
much. And remember, every second you are with your animal, you are training it. Don't ever forget that. And there's that other question there that you've got in that list, I think, Ryan. That one says...
The last one?
Well, the second last one in my thing. Anyway, it just says, how can I work in a space where not everyone is involved in training?
Let's move on to
the next. Alrighty. Yeah, I can. How can I work in a space where not everyone is involved in the training in an equal capacity? Was that from a trainer who's working in a group of animals or a single animal? Or
that question came from one individual, and I know who that individual is, but I won't say that on the podcast. But I feel like I get that question a lot. And there's numerous, let's say two specific situations. One's in a household where someone's trying to initiate positive reinforcement training or a proper environmental arrangement, and not everyone's got buy-in, so the animal's being reinforced for the opposite of what this individual is trying to teach, or things in the environment aren't being set up for the animal to succeed, quite the opposite. And also in zoos and teams, you know, one person's trying to work towards managing behavior in this particular fashion, the fashion that, you know, you and I talk about is quite often the questions I get asked about. I'm trying to implement positive reinforcement and correct environmental arrangement, but I don't have buy-in from the team, and I feel like I'm kind of just pushing against a brick wall here. I guess those are the two situations that I've been asked questions about personally.
Yep. I think when you're teaching new behaviours, then it should be a one-on-one situation. I think that's easiest. But I think also as a team in an institution, you should all agree about the style of the way you're going to teach the animals to allow them to learn more effectively. So that's that aspect of it, is that the team has to learn to work together and to understand the value of being consistent in their approach to each of their animals. It's certainly not necessary that everyone works in the same capacity with each individual. That's not going to happen, certainly not in the early stages. It's important that behavior is actively shaped at all times. There is opportunity for interaction with the animal as an individual and the group of animals that you're working with as well. You can have a proper team unless everyone's working on the same page, really.
Yeah, I guess I can offer some input from my experience anyway, and what I found worked. And I think patience is key. Just be patient with people, and they're obviously going to be patient with you as well. If you've got conflicting views and you're in a time restraint situation or space where you don't have time to kind of sit down and talk about these things.
One thing that I find is useful is that when you are going to change the style of what's going on the property, and I've had a bit of experience with that now where I've walked in to change the style of training across the whole institution, is that it's important for management particularly to support the change. It can't be done from the bottom. It has to be supported ideally from the top. And then I can come in and set a stage and show people what's possible with this style and this approach. And then we can look at individual issues within different sections as well. I don't spend a lot of time arguing the point. I want management, if they are there to support change, then it is best coming from the top and then trickling down and allowing people the time to learn to understand the reason for change.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it comes down to education and of management.
Yep.
Yeah, so you got to be educated, and sometimes in those situations you don't have time to sit down and kind of have those discussions. So in those situations, yeah, like I said, you got to be patient. But I also think, for me anyway, results have always kind of won out over the end. If I'm saying, you know, I'm going to try this, but it might not have buy-in, and I'm always being persistent, and I always put that time in every single day, and in the end we get behavior and we get high animal welfare and happy animals and all that kind of stuff. And I think the behaviors have always won out, and then that's the kind of thing where people can see it with their own eyes, they start to change their perception as well. Because for me and for you and for people where they've done lots of animal training, it's easy to look at a situation kind of have ideas about where you're going to start to try to get the behaviors you want, and have lots of references in your mind as to where it's led to success in the past. But if someone doesn't have those references, then I think, yeah, the results kind of end up speaking for themselves. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's where it's useful to have a bank of stuff to expose people to at the beginning. And it's not necessarily what you're going to be attacking or approaching at that institution necessarily, but at least getting people excited and on side about the potential and possibilities. And I guess that's what I've found. I've done not so long ago a consult at an organization where they were switching over from a traditional style of training, which was based on negative reinforcement, and they were producing a high quality product, which was an animal that worked with people. We were switching over entirely to using positive reinforcement. And the first step was to show that everybody who contacts every animal on the property is a trainer, not just those with the name of trainer. And then to show what was possible, and then to open the door, and once you've excited people, that to open the door and they can put their hands up and say, oh, this is a problem and that's a problem. And then give them ownership of different points in the cog and actively reinforce the behavior of the humans. I think that's, I guess, what I've learned to become is not the person who goes in and does all the training. That's basically inefficient. But what I want to be doing is to go in there and inspire others to go about creating change. But as I said, the best way of that actually happening is that management are there to allow that to go ahead. And it often requires a high level of time input to begin with. But after things get going and behaviors start happening and animals start showing you that they are appreciating the style change, that sort of feeds the behavior of the humans, and it feeds the behavior of the animals as well. It's extremely exciting. And then to see, you know, like to go away for a little while and then to go back and people show you in an excited fashion, oh, look what we did. We managed to do, for instance, x-rays of dogs without needing to sedate them anymore, because they can just sit there and they're happy to do it, and they're not frightened of the noise of the machinery and blah, blah, blah anymore, because we've spent the time and we've created that comfort in that space. And little things that everybody can take ownership of, and then I get out there and actively reinforce it, and management reinforce it as well. So management have to understand that initially it's time is the biggest investment. Time is important, but once things get going, things flow really efficiently. And in the end, what we know from this organization is that by using positive reinforcement as the primary tool for teaching and training dogs in question, they have a higher retention rate within the program and far less economic wastage of animals throughout the program. It was the welfare of the animals overall is better, there's less monetary wasting, and the product that they produce is more confident and more reliable when it's out there in the real world. I just think it's one of the most rich examples of what's possible. And it's not just about me, it's about the whole management reinforcing it and creating change and inspiration within their staff. It was a really valuable program to be involved in.
That's cool. Hey, I think this has been a really good podcast, and I think we have had some really cool ideas. There have been some pretty broad questions there, and the answer to all of them is it really comes down to understanding and education and how behavior works, and then taking a lens out and examining your individual animal's environment and the reinforcers and punishers in play within that space, setting the environments up so we're making desirable behaviors easier to perform, and also in a way that the reinforcers are paired with those desirable behaviors. Two main things I think about understanding behavior from, you got to understand from a scientific perspective, and then put the microscope over your individual animal's circumstances, and of course keep learning about this stuff. And there's plenty of free and great content for you to get your teeth stuck into straight away at Animal Training Academy. And of course, we've got those up and coming webinars as well. We get those opportunities to ask questions live as well. So can't wait for that. And on Facebook, head over to Creative Animal Solutions. There is a wealth of information. And I've had great feedback from my friends, Kat, who have joined.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they said they love the content you're putting up there.
It's very broad. And I guess what I would say, just as an addendum to what you've just said, Ryan, is that I guess what we've all got to remember is to treat, I put it up on Creative Animal Solutions, the little Facebook page that I moderate every now and then, is that we all need to remember to treat each other with the same respect as we afford the animals in our lives. So remember that as well, and try and apply the positive reinforcement aspect to your relationships with other people. It doesn't always work easily, but it is worth persisting with, I can assure you, in the long run, because if you can create trust between humans that work together, the welfare of the animals will improve with which you work just the same.
Yeah, and I love training animals, and I love, and you were saying it was exciting before when your animals kind of learn this new way of learning. You can kind of see behaviors that you might interpret as happy or excited. But for me as well, yeah, when you get that trust in those human relationships and you work in a team, and I always think about it as synergistic, and you have a synergistic team, things just happen and they happen fast, and it's pretty magical. And of course, all the animals benefit from that. So completely agree. Hey, thanks for those. Thanks for those questions from the audience we have addressed in this podcast. And we have a list of other questions as well that over time we'll be answering in some way, shape or form. But as always, we love hearing from you. So please say hi. Tell us your thoughts, good or bad, on what you just listened to. We want to know what you guys like and don't like. And also send us some more questions and just say g'day, kia ora, howdy, whatever.
Giggle.
All right. Anything else to add before we wrap that up?
Nah, a big smile emoticon. I think that's about it.
Smile emoticons all around. Thank you, everyone. See you next
time. Bye. Bye.